I can eat a page for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effenbirds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington, editor-in-chief of The Spool and a senior writer for Consequence of Sound.
My name is Nathan Raven, and I write for a website called Nathan Raven's Happy Place. They let me write for them, which was very sweet and very nice, and I really, really appreciate. Also, I've got a bit of a Philip K. Dick thing going on, and that I'm very confused sense of self. Also, I write books. I just wrote a book called The Weird Accordion Owl, and more pointedly for this particular episode, I wrote a book called Postal with our guest, Mr. Brock Wildboar. Brock, thank you for coming on.
It's so good to be here. And it is such a personally complicated thing to watch Nathan have to promote two books simultaneously. I realize that one of the books you are probably making a lot more money off of personally, but it is very funny that like we were getting nice blurbs for the back of the book. And Nathan was like, I wish I would have used this one on my book. I was like, but also we have one that's coming out at the same time. Like, yeah, it's difficult to do promotion on both.
Yeah, right, that it's synergy, baby. It's all about synergy.
Yeah, right, but sometimes you just promote
the one.
This book
was like 5 years in the making, right?
But
it was
the other one.
Well, that was 3 years in the making. So it only took me 8 years to write these two books. And now I'm
flossing. And in a better world, we would have planned out a staggering system for them. So we could have had at least a month or two in between. But no.
Instead of confronting people with our staggering awesomeness.
Indeed. And speaking of which, I'm very glad to have you on, Brock, to help us through maybe one of the weirder, like maybe less eventful entries in our particular purview here, which for those of you who
I'm curious about it because I was supposed to come on for the Vampire's Kiss episode, and I was ready to do a full 2 hours about Vampire's Kiss and American Psycho, and because I hadn't seen Vampire's Kiss finding it on streaming is near impossible. Until it showed up on Shudder just before that episode was supposed to record. And it's one of the wildest things I've ever seen. And then I wound up going to the hospital the day before we were supposed to record. And so now I'm stuck with this fucking episode, which does not feel like the consolation prize I should have gotten.
I just want to say that the consolation, such as there is, one of the things that I found interesting about Time to Kill, one of the only things I found, I found it to be a fairly fascinating movie, is I felt like there are a lot of echoes of Vampire's Kiss. Right. I kind of felt like part of the reason why he liked this weird role in an Italian movie, a bona fide Italian movie, where people are speaking Italian, except for him. Was because there are so many echoes kind of thematically, stylistically. You know, he plays a monster who does horrible things and, you know, pays a price for it, and then he doesn't, ?
Right. But yes. Before we get too ahead of ourselves, we should explain what the podcast is and what it does.
Okay.
So for those of you who are listening in for our first episode, we go through the filmographies of one Sir John Travolta and one Sir Nicolas Cage in chronological order. We're finding connections. We're seeing how these like two exceedingly weird guys move through the world of Hollywood. And this episode, we've reached sort of the end, I think, of an era of early like Travolta stardom, Nick Cage coming up in his like uncle's movies kind of crazy phase where, Vampire's Kiss, I think, was a turning point where like this is when Cage has reached his final form, so to speak, the form he will live in for the next few decades. And Travolta is now just like kind of slumming it and kind of waiting for Tarantino to save him a little bit.
Now, when you guys planned this out at the start, which after I asked my question, my other question is, why did this happen? But the real question is, when you planned it out, does their filmography sort of have a similar number of entries, and do those entries really sort of line up by year, or do you reach a point where like one is a decade ahead of another one?
Way to point out the fatal flaw in our conceit here. To answer your question, Mr. Cage, if I'm not mistaken, has been in substantially more movies than Mr. Travolta. He got a much later start, but then he just made a fuck ton of movies.
The ones that line up are you sort of watching movies that like are almost in the same year, so like the quality is sort of.
They started in very different times. You know, Travolta started in the mid-70s, you know, with Carrie, Boy in the Plastic Bubble, 75, 76. And then Nicolas Cage, you know, if you don't include his delirious, strange stint as a wacky variety comedy star opposite Crispin Glover, America's sweetheart. He kind of started in 82, 83. But we're getting to a point now where they're kind of matching up. You know, right. Basements is from 1987. Time to Kill is from 1989. And again, I feel like one of the things that kind of makes this fascinating, I'm hoping this is fascinating, is the weird ways in which they kind of echo and they're kind of simpatico. And I feel like this is very much the case as well, where you know, this finds them on foreign territory in a very real sense, and that these are foreign movies set in foreign countries where they're playing foreign characters, and only one of them actually attempts an accent.
With varying degrees of commitment.
Yeah, so we're at some point we will just run out of John Travolta movies, and we'll have like 30 crappy direct-to-video Nicolas Cage movies. But there'll also be stuff like Mandy and Mom and Dad, and like all these fascinating, you know, Color Out of Space, all these like fascinating comeback movies that also will be 4 or 5 years from now. Also, I'm guessing John Travolta will make a lot more movies. I'm actually going to write him a letter and encourage him to, you know, make 40 or 50 just to even things up a little. Solely for
is there an idea that at some point when you run out of Travolta films, you'll just sub in a different actor, like suddenly the show is Malkovich Cage or something like that.
Well, I think you brought up John Cusack as being a somewhat and like this, definitely in terms of the. Oh, good Lord. Okay, I need to go open the door for my son. Okay. I also just want to say that if this is your first episode, this should not be your first episode. Listen to all the others. This might be what I give you permission to skip.
This is filler. There is no killer, all filler on this one. It's going to be interesting.
Nathan's currently opening the door, just like Coppola did for his nephew. Right. We're really leaning into this.
I can't help but wonder what other Con Air co-stars we're going to pitch for to take over for Travolta. Just Buscemi Cage.
Well, I've got actually a project that I'm very excited about called Trejo Adejo. I swear to God, as soon as Control Nathan Raymond 2020 ends, that's the year in which I allowed my readers and my patrons to choose which theme months I have and what I write about for my website. After that is over, I'm going to watch a different Danny Trejo movie every single day, kind of for the sake of the silly wordplay, but then kind of, you know, he's a fascinating human being, and I'm gonna, you know, the short films,
but there's
television
so many
shows.
Films.
That's the whole point. That's the whole point. Is for 365 days, I will watch and write about a different Danny Trejo project every single day, and he was in Con Air, so there will be overlap and overlap. It's very exciting. Actually, like I have a lot of weird overlaps in my books. Dave Foley actually is a guest star on Comedy Bang Bang, the fifth season, which I'll be writing about for the extended version of the Weird Gordon Al book, which means that he's in the Weird Gordon Al, he's in Postal, and he's in Meyer Flops. So he somehow has become a semi-central figure in three of the six books that I have published.
The Foley-verse.
Yes, the Foley-verse. Yes, yes.
But going back to our two actors that we're supposed to talk about this week. Nathan alluded to, we're going to be talking about two different movies that you've never seen and you probably shouldn't.
And you've never heard of them either.
Never heard of
which
them.
Which is fascinating because one is a Robert Altman movie written by Harold Pinter.
Right. And to be fair, like we're technically talking about Basements, the two-part Robert Altman TV special thing where he like adapted two different picture plays. Yeah, it's a TV movie where he adapted two different
picture plays. Oh, I did not know that this was a TV movie. I thought this went to theaters and I was horrified.
Oh, God, no. This was part of the time when about half of Altman's movies went into the theaters and the other were on television.
I got to understand more of Robert Altman one day.
His 80s are fucking fascinating. I mean, I'm a proponent of the movie O.C. and Stiggs, which was a teen sex comedy that I really, really like, and I can mount kind of a contrarian.
For TV?
No, for it was, okay. It was his National Lampoon movie. Robert Altman did a National Lampoon teen sex comedy in the mid-80s.
Which they then rebooted into the O.C.,
yes, exactly.
My
and it's kind of a 80s. And it's kind of like a weird sequel to Nashville, because the big politician is also figures prominently. Like, yeah, if you want to go into like a very weird, interesting, dark rabbit hole in which all of the movies are better than Basements, I recommend exploring Robert Altman's lost decade in the 1980s.
I think we could agree that Basements is the basement of that dark hole.
He has reached the floor of his creative potential. Yes,
well, that is true for sure,
and has gone below.
It's an offbeat comedy starring Tom Conti and John Travolta. They're hitmen heading for a new assignment, but not everything's what it appears to be. Before the night is over, someone will die. The Dumbwaiter is produced and directed by Robert Altman, one of America's premier film talents. The New York Times calls it subtle, evocative, multi-layered, slyly humorous, ambitious, and offbeat. Altman, Travolta, and Conti keep things fast and lively. Smart entertainment, says the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Soup of the day, liver and onions, jam tart.
We better send something up.
Eh?
We better send something up.
One McVitie and Price, one Red Label, one packet of Smith's Crisp and Eccles Cake, and a bar of chocolate.
Cadbury's. A bottle of milk.
A half pint of milk, E. Widows and Sons Dairy. Just made it. That's a bit funny, isn't it?
No, it's not funny at all.
Who has got it now?
What do you mean, who's got it now?
Who's got it now? If they moved out, who moved in?
It all depends on you.
Newsday calls Tom Conti's performance brilliant. Don't miss Tom Conti and John Travolta in The Dumbwaiter.
So let's talk about that real quick, because it technically takes up two specials, but Travolta's only in one, right? He's only in The Dumbwaiter, which is what we should probably talk about.
And then the other is The Room.
Oh, well,
yeah. Well, you guys watch that, right? You guys watch a bunch of unprofessional pieces of crap who slough off your responsibility and didn't watch the movie The Room.
No.
There's actually a foreign horror film that came out this year that we saw at a festival that's fantastic. It's about two people that have a room in their house where anything that they wish for can come true, and it gets dark very quickly.
So it's the opposite of The Disappointments Room?
Exactly, but whoever was in charge of U.S. marketing named it The Room, and we saw the trailer for it before we saw it at this festival. It's like, that movie looks great. No one's going to go see The Room. Somebody should have lost their job over that one. And the movie is great. So,
Well, I will. And Brock, did you watch The Room? The other version or the other movie in this particular twofer?
No, I did what I was assigned to do.
Oh, my goodness. Well, if I can give it some very faint praise, that is the more interesting and the more engaging of the two short films. I guess those will be short films. They're two very, very early plays by Harold Pinter. I guess The Room, I think maybe it was his first play. And he wrote it in 2 days, and it was inspired by a visit to Quentin Crisp. Quentin Crisp, the great writer and bon vivant. Apparently he's like, wow, Quentin Crisp has a really shitty home. I should write a play about his incredibly depressing home.
You know, in America we call him Quentin Potato Chip.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That was offensively bad, that joke there.
You're welcome.
That kind of humor has no place in a discussion of Harold Pinter. So guys, let's talk about The Dumbwaiter. Which of you guys wants the honor of discussing the plot?
I call not
such
it.
As it is. Brock, you have a degree from Northwestern in theater.
Yeah.
Do you not? In Harold Pinter studies, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, no, I, I was watching and I was like, what am I seeing? And I pulled up the Wikipedia knowing that I might encounter spoilers. And that was then that I realized that this was a film based on a Pinter play and made by Altman, two things I didn't know before going in. But this was also the thing that made me consider, do I actually like Harold Pinter? Because in college, I used to like say like, I really like him, but maybe it's like saying that you like Thomas Pynchon novels and you're just like, I didn't really read it, but like, I want to sound smart to people. Yeah. Like I remember loving The Birthday Party and wanting to stage productions of that. And like watching this, I'm like, oh, do I like Harold Pinter? I don't think I do.
Oh, Harold Pinter was up his own ass.
Yeah. This half of the movie, The Dumbwaiter, is about two bank robbers, right?
I think they're hitmen.
They're hitmen. Okay.
And so, okay, maybe we should find someone else to describe.
they're hiding out. They're hiding out in a basement.
The titular basement
for both movies. They're hiding out and they're having an odd time with each other, doing what you would expect from a Harold Pinter play, where everyone is just having different conversations and that's supposed to come off as smart. Wow, I don't like Harold Pinter. Shit.
And, they're just kind of fucking around.
They're in the basement of like a hotel, and all of a sudden the dumbwaiter in the middle of the room comes down with a request for food. And there's also a little tube that you can use to talk to people upstairs. And more requests start coming down, and they're trying to figure out if they should fill those requests so that people don't know they're there, or try to tell them like we're out of that particular food. And that keeps going for some reason. That's the best I have for what this is. Who wants to tag it on with a further plot?
I think the most interesting about this motion picture, which is very peculiar, and again, a part of me is like, is this just boring as shit, or am I dumb? Or is it some combination of the two? Do I just not understand or appreciate Pinter?
And that's the Pinter thing, that maybe you default to saying, like, this is very smart, when actually it's just so fucking stupid, but we don't want to admit that, like, we don't get it.
Like, yeah, kind of the Emperor's New Clothes type dynamic going on. And then one of the things that kind of interests me about this is he has very distinct rhythms. Yeah, it's almost the rhythms and the structure and like the staccato sensibility that seems to matter as much, if not more, than the actual words, which can seem very confusing. It's one of the things that struck me about both of these is you have to pay very, very close attention to figure out what's going on. Otherwise, you'll think they're bank robbers. I similarly went to Wikipedia and thought, what the fuck is going on in this ridiculous thing? And I think the thing that's most notable about this is that John Travolta, New Jersey's own John Travolta, has a mullet and he has the world's worst Cockney accent.
Oh, God.
Just an unacceptably bad accent. Like, I don't think it really comes off in the trailer, so you would have to actually find the YouTube video of this, which, by the way, both movies today are only available on YouTube.
And like, the version of The Dumbwaiter you can find on YouTube has, like, Israeli subtitles?
Yeah.
It's wild, but it still really maintains the VHS quality of what I assume the TV movie was. Like, it's awful.
Well, and it's funny, too, because I guess somebody realized, like, hey, we've got John Travolta in a video cassette. We can sell this to people as long as they have no idea what this movie is anything like. Mm-hmm. So there is a hilariously misguided VHS cover where this incredibly like punishing
the odd couple.
It totally sex comedy.
It's way more Neil Simon than Harold Pinter.
Well, yeah, it's the two of them they're dressed up like waiters, which again, they're not waiters. They're not waiters at all. It's like some weird clumsy metaphor.
They looked more like leisure suits. They were out on the town.
No,
but yes,
I think they were both in waiter costumes, upscale.
Yeah,
waiter
it looked
costumes.
Like waiter costumes for me.
Okay, I'm fine. I get it. I don't know any of their jobs.
These dumb idiots. Look at these dumb dubs. So one of them was carrying a Tom Conti. The dumber one was carrying a tray full of money and it's falling down. And then John Travolta is having a tray and it's got a gun in it. And again, these are elements in the film. They work for money and they have guns. But again, this is like a zany sex comedy cover for a movie that is punishingly dry and just kind of punishing most of the time. And John Travolta is bizarrely miscast. He has this cockney. It's just, it's distracting. It's so distracting, I couldn't get beyond.
Going back to the Pinter thing and sort of the inscrutability of it all, like I think if you were to be charitable, you'd say the inscrutability is the point. Like there this sort
it's supposed
of
to be obtuse. It's willingly obtuse, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, this sort of Sartrean sort of nihilism happening where these two people are kind of in this room for no reason, sort of faffing about because they don't have anything to do, and then sort of just having these conversations, and there's supposed to be sort of insight in there. Like, I think, I'm sure there's something there about the sort of class dynamics between this, like, Cockney young kid and this older Scotsman who's, like, more experienced or whatever, and their dynamic, but it's all so difficult to parse that you, by the time you realize that it's a it's supposed to be about nothing, you're too bored to care.
Oh, perfect. And also, can we talk about the other actor in his, who is one of the weirdest character actors I have ever encountered?
yeah, Tom Conti, who, I mean, I think he does, like, a decent job with the material. And you, I
think he does a good job with the material. I think he's very well suited for this. I feel like that's part of the problem, is that he's excessively British and excessively theatrical, and John Travolta is like an American entertainer. I mean, that's the thing about him, is he's fun, he's dynamic, he has a great personality, he can sing, he can dance. He's not a heavyweight actor in the same way that Nicolas Cage is. You know, he's not, doesn't have that Brando intensity to it. And without any entertaining to do, his shortcomings as a hardcore thespian, I think, are a lot more apparent.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I kind of felt bad between the accent and sort of the dynamic. I felt bad for Tom Conti having to act alongside Travolta, like having to hear that Cockney accent, that half Cockney accent.
And this is a total two-hander, you know? This is two people in a room. And that's one of the things that I think is kind of interesting and maddening about this is I love Robert Altman, and he's one of those filmmakers who is so distinctive that their last name is an adjective. Like when you describe something as Altman-esque, you know what people are talking about. You know, certain camera moves, improvisation, you know, sort of intense collaboration between actor and director. And I feel like this is one of the least Altman-esque films he's ever done. And part of the stuff is usually so lively and humane and bursting with life. And this is just fucking deadly. And it's so dry and so intensely claustrophobic that it's, again, you feel like you're in a fucking room with these two people, and it's not a pleasurable sensation. And that's part of the reason, if I might further out myself as a fucking idiot, this reminded me a lot of Waiting for Godot, with the caveat, I have not seen Waiting for Godot. I'm guessing that hopefully one of you two theater people have. Is that an accurate...
I think that everyone in the world can use that line and uses it correctly. You're doing it right. That you don't have to see it to understand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are sort of, again, like two people sort of spending time, like they're waiting for something to happen, and they're just sort of figuring each other out as they do that, or maybe even not. So yeah, you're just sort of watching them faff around this like stage, and you know, it affects the feel of a film stage play in all of its like strengths and weaknesses. And I think, like, you know, you mentioned Altman being a very lively filmmaker, and I think that's true, but I think there are also moments when he's very subdued. He's known for very naturalistic dialogue and sort of very naturalistic staging at times. And this feels like the worst instincts of Altman combined with the worst instincts of Pinter. So it's just like a nothing burger of a TV movie.
Well, it feels like he's serving Pinter, and he's not serving him well. And it's just a fundamental mismatch. And again, there are movies from this era of his career that I really love. Secret Honor, which kind of sort of the one-man show about Richard Nixon in his later years, sort of looking at the world through regret, kind of introduced the world to Philip Baker Hall. Like, I love that movie, and it's so theatrical, and it's such a Robert Altman movie. And part of that is, you know, it's a one-man show, and he's able to do, like, overlapping dialogue, you know, because there's, like, really cool radio electric and sound editing. And with this, again, it just kind of feels like – it just feels so rote. And, like, he had, you know, six TV movies he had to do for ABC, and he ground this one out and then went on to the next thing.
Yeah, I mean, there is sort of absurdism to a fault here, to the point where characters will get bogged down in whether or not you say – you know, put the gas on or put the kettle on. And it's, I can feel that there is something more significant that's supposed to be happening there, but I can't parse it.
Well, and I think part of that also is sort of about the cruelty and inevitability of fate, and that yeah. one of these gentlemen, you know, gets the call, and it is to kill the other. And again, I, judging by Wikipedia, where I got many of my ideas from here, it's supposed to be political. It's supposed to be about corruption and about, you know, capitalism and about the cruelty of inevitability, you know, of this world. But it just feels so dry and so deadly. And especially, I mean, compared to, like, fucking Perfect, which is a movie with a big old boner that's incredibly dumb. It's like set to like a freaking Jermaine Jackson song the entire time. And then just looking at Travolta's career, it's so fucking weird that between 1985 and 1989, when he was really at the core of his career, when he could have turned things around, when he could have made these movies that would, you know, make his reputation, that could make his comeback even sooner, he wasn't doing anything. He was in one, you know, Pinter adaptation that went absolutely nowhere. He was in Experts, which was filmed, I think, in 86 and then not released until 1989. Just like, what the hell is going on with his career? And in this time, you know, Nicolas Cage is making these incredibly dynamic, exciting movies. So again, you just wonder, like, what the hell was going on in John Travolta's life?
Right. I mean, and it's not even a case of, you know, working with the greats too, because I mean, he's working with Robert Altman here, but I just think there's such a weird mismatch of actor with material. I wonder if he like was starting to feel sort of the years, I guess, and he wanted to start to transition into a more like serious actor, quote unquote. And maybe this was a, I'm going to do the theater. It reminded me of like Keanu Reeves doing Macbeth, that kind of stuff. And sort of how outsized that can sort
right,
of
Keanu
be.
Keanu Reeves did Macbeth?
Or something like that. He did Hamlet. I don't remember. I'm a big old dum-dum. I got a theater degree, too, for some reason. but it's that case of that classic thing of like a movie star trying to gain credibility by doing theater, by treading the board, so to speak. And this feels like Travolta trying to do that, and it doesn't really super work.
Do you want to talk about how it ends, which is maybe the only interesting part?
Yeah, go for it. Brock, would you like
no,
to talk
no,
about
not
how
me,
this...
No, not me, I don't understand.
Because oh. I wasn't interested in how it ended.
Okay, then if no one's interested, let's leave it.
So yeah, I mean, one of them dies, that's all that matters. It turns out, the call was coming from inside the house. That's basically it, and it's like, it's...
Oh, and just Tom Conti is an interesting character actor. I feel like he did a really good job here. He lends a certain pathos to the character. There's a certain childlike element to him. He has a really terrible haircut and a Hitler mustache. And then Tom Conti's daughter is actually a really interesting ventriloquist, which is not a phrase I ever use outside of this particular podcast. But yeah, so an interesting family. And this looks so interesting on paper. I'm like, wow, how can he... It also made me feel like I wish that Robert Altman had collaborated with John Travolta on a bigger and better and more interesting project. Because, yeah, I think that chemistry would be really interesting if they weren't in a project that played against both of their strengths in a really intense, really dramatic kind of way.
For sure. So from an actor trying too hard to not play American to an actor not trying hard enough to not play American, let's talk about Time to Kill.
I went to the creek. And I washed the blood off my hands and out of my shirt. And I remember I wanted to scream. I wanted to pull out my eyes. And then I left. I didn't get very far, but before I heard this mournful sound, like some primitive violin playing. I couldn't tell if it was a religious procession or a picnic. All I could think of was that they were Marnie's people.
Yes. That's the whole story.
Yes, goddammit, I told you everything. Why can't you listen?
Nathan, do you want to take this one? What is Time to Kill about? That's the Sam Jackson one, right?
It is not. That is the John
Grisham. I watched that one instead.
The John Grisham blockbuster of the same name. Now, this was a movie that I did not know existed until this project came about. It's a 1989 Italian movie. He stars in a genuine Italian movie where everybody other than him is speaking Italian. And as we saw in
The Boy in Blue,
Nicolas Cage plays a period film and plays a foreigner. He does not make any effort whatsoever to sound non-American or to sound non-contemporary. This was equally intense here and even more kind of fascinating and bizarre. But I also appreciated him not doing a terrible accent that would have taken me out of the movie the way that John Travolta's Cockney accent does in Basements. So Nicolas Cage plays a very tortured, very intense Italian soldier in Ethiopia.
I like that Nicolas Cage's voice choice here pulled you out less than the other one. These both feel... But
part of it was that I, again, as you mentioned, this is only available on YouTube. And the first 10 minutes, I'm like, oh, I should, you know, do the right thing and the cinephile thing and watch this in its original language and watch it in the original Italian. And I started to watch it, and Nicolas Cage is dubbed. And he's dubbed by somebody who does not sound anything like Nicolas Cage. And I'm thinking, I'm watching this movie for Nicolas Cage. That's the whole purpose of this. So I switched over to the dubbed, which usually is the bad move, and you know, you feel like a Philistine. But considering that this is a Nicolas Cage movie, and that's what's interesting about it, and that's kind of all that's interesting about it, it seemed very appropriate. So he's a very tortured character, and he is wandering, and he meets a beautiful Ethiopian woman, and he sexually assaults her. And this is one of those many, many, many disturbing, problematic representations of rape from the 1970s and 60s and 80s, where they depict it as... starts off as a sexual assault, and then it turns into something else.
As soon as the sexual assault is over, immediately she reaches over and like grabs his hand and loves him, and it is a native woman who does not speak the language, and the rape comes almost as soon as he meets her, and that is actually why I stopped watching the movie at this point. I was like, no, it's actually cr-. So like this week on the episode, I watched one half of two different movies, which weren't appropriate, and that I got the point.
Yeah,
the Ethiopian woman
in question ends up getting killed by Nicolas Cage on accident several minutes later.
Never mind, I did get to that point. I was like, so there was a rape and a fridging in under 5 minutes. Like, I think I'm done here.
Yeah. it's that kind of, because it's based on a novel by Ennio Flaiano, and it's from the director of Sacco and Vanzetti, I think. And it feels very Italian. It feels that very kind of like it's also that
it
same
has
kind
the,
of like
it has war the same
story.
Cinematographer as Cinema Paradiso.
Yeah, and Ennio Morricone did the score, that kind of stuff. So it has all the trappings of this like Killing Fields-esque sort of meditation on war and conflict and colonialism. And I feel like they tried to do it in fits and spurts, but otherwise it's just kind of really muddled.
Yeah, well, to get back to the plot, so what happens is that he goes and then he sexually assaults this woman, and then again, there's this, she looks at him adoringly in a way that's really, really problematic. And I think one of the things that's it's maddening about this movie is I feel like on some level it's trying to comment on racism and sexism and colonialism, and how, you know, these soldiers, you know, these fascist soldiers, for Italians, they look down on these people as subhuman, and they're only good for sex and you know, they're children.
But those monsters are also the heroes.
Right, but I'm also, but again, yeah. I feel like part of the problem is they're trying to comment on racism and sexism as imperialism while also being racist, sexist, and imperialist in the same way. And I think part of what would have been interesting for you, Brock, had you watched more of the movie, is I feel like it kind of turns into Vampire's Kiss at this point, because Nicolas Cage discovers that, you know, if the Ethiopian women wear a turban, wear a white on their head if they have leprosy. And, you know, these women, and they have leprosy. leprosy, and he's like, oh my god, I have leprosy, this is terrible, like, what am I gonna do? And it's very much like Vampire's Kiss, and I think, you know, as a physical actor, Nicolas Cage goes to some really dark places, and he's sort of this physical and moral and spiritual dissipation as he gets crazier and crazier and more, I guess, kind of greeting or embracing his doom and his death and this disease. And then he finds out that he doesn't have leprosy. And there's a weird happy ending? Question mark. So I think I found Nicolas Cage's performance really interesting. I felt like the echoes of Vampire's Kiss were really interesting. I feel like in the environment we're in now, the idea of somebody being like, oh my god, I don't have any symptoms. I don't know. I don't have any proof. But I just feel in my soul like I have this horrible disease that will kill me. But first, it will make my life terrible in so many ways. Like, I felt like that was weirdly resonant and weirdly timely. Even if otherwise, this is a very... And the other thing that I really found fascinating is I thought Giancarlo Giannini, the other big-name actor, was really good and really interesting and brought a lot of life and color to the role of, yeah, this kind of a very eccentric sort of officer who embraced his life, and who, yeah, Nicolas Cage ends up fucking over because he is a horrible person who deserves to suffer, and he does suffer, but then he doesn't suffer. So it's very strange, and yeah, the echoes of Vampire's Kiss I thought were interesting. Did that strike you, Clint, that these were two kind of like simpatico movies?
Yeah, there is Cage is kind of in a really interesting mode here, where he's a diseased Cage is always very fascinating because he loves
a diseased sort of Cage. Oh, it's a whole category of Cage movies. That's incredible. Oh,
yeah, we've unlocked it, folks. Because even apart from the leprosy thing, the whole framing device of the movie is centered around him talking to this surgeon who's like, because he has a toothache,
right,
and he needs to get a tooth extracted, and so he becomes a sort of confessor a little bit.
Which can we agree is a more Harold Pinter choice, that like a soldier who's done rape and now has a disease is just talking to his dentist while the dentist just talks to him about a tooth.
Right, exactly. And you sort of get this sense of moral and spiritual decay in this whole thing too. Like, I mean, you do get those glimmers that like their presence is not great, and like he's surrounded by all of these army officers. Well,
they're fucking fascists. I mean, these are the soldiers of Mussolini. You know, you can't really lose track of that. Beyond the rape and the killing, he's also a fascist.
A fascist, a cowardly fascist too, because he wants to nothing more than to go home.
But he has really beautiful eyes. and he's still, this is kind of the ripped, you know, sort of Nicolas Cage is a beautiful specimen, which again is very disconcerting in light of the horrible things that his character does. And also that, again, this is one of those films that it's like, it starts out as rape and then turns into something beautiful. It's like, no, that is so wrong and so irresponsible and so, you know, cancerous to a movie's core. I felt like one of the other things that this kind of had in common with Vampire's Kiss is that he confesses. You know, he confesses to the horrible things that he does, and nobody cares because he's a good-looking white
man. And because he killed a woman.
Yes, because he killed a black woman. He killed an African woman. And those lives are not... And again, there's the sense of, you know, well, these guys wouldn't see this culture and these people as multidimensional, as human, as being any kind of equals. But there's also the sense of, well, the movie doesn't feel any differently.
And Vampire's Kiss, he's also killed a woman, and that's why no one cares. Like, this transfers across.
Yeah, he's protected by his
and committed,
like,
he commits sexual assault in that as well. So in both of these movies, he's actually assaults people, and he kills people, and he thinks he has either leprosy or vampirism. This is a very bewildering choice for Cage too. I mean, you look at, like, because he was on such an amazing hot streak, you know, Peggy Sue Got Married, Moonstruck, Raising Arizona, Vampire's Kiss. I mean, these are big movies with juicy roles for him. For him to like go to Italy or whatever the hell they filmed this movie and do this weird film that, you know, would be received like a foreign film, because it is a foreign film and not, you know, some Oscar bait critically acclaimed one. It's a peculiar choice, but I respect the hell out of it, and it gives Cage a lot to work with, even if the film itself is incredibly problematic.
Yeah, it's absolutely one of those, it's a different time kind of movies. Yeah, it's kind of a rough watch, especially in the beginning, and you kind of, especially from a modern perspective, it's hard to come back from that first act with the Ethiopian woman, and it's hard to sort of sympathize with him. And like, to a certain extent, the movie knows that, but it doesn't go far enough.
Are we supposed to sympathize with him? Because I think that's one of the things. Is, again, I feel like he's the protagonist and the antihero and the villain all at the same time, and I feel like sort of depending on the time and the culture and the perspective, you see him in those different roles. And I think from 2020, it's hard to see him as anything but, you know, a monster and somebody who does horrible things and who suffers, but maybe doesn't suffer enough and doesn't deserve, you know, the redemption or the release or the, but at the same time, like, is that a commentary on colonialism and racism and the fact that you can do these horrible things, but if you live in this system, if you live in this world, you will get away with it. You get to go home to your beautiful wife, you know?
Right. I mean, I think the fact that the movie ends with like some sort of like the stock footage and stuff of like the stuff happening in Ethiopia makes me think that they are cognizant of like the evils of this kind of regime and this occupation. But it's just like by centering it on such a, you know, by centering it in the main character's perspective and like his interiority and by casting sort of such a likable actor, it's like Cage. Yeah. I think that muddies the waters just enough.
What did you think of Giancarlo Giannini?
He was good. I'm a big fan of his from the weirdest, dumbest place from the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries version of Dune.
Yes.
That was my introduction to him.
Well, this was, I just watched him in Once Upon a Crime.
And I wish he was dressed here like he was dressed in Dune. That's all I'm saying.
So I just watched him in Once Upon a Crime, sort of the Eugene Levy directed, Dino De Laurentiis produced. This is actually, I think De Laurentiis was involved in this as well. And he was really, really good. And I was looking him up on Wikipedia. And one of the things that he does is he's huge in dubbing. So if you watch the Italian version of The Shining, that's Giancarlo Giannini as the voice of Jack Nicholson. And he, like Al Pacino, like there are a bunch of like really heavyweight actors when their movies go to Italy. Giancarlo Giannini goes into a recording studio and does all of that stuff. And I'm guessing that's probably why he did the Italian and the American voices here, because he's very talented in a number of different languages, which is very impressive. Also, I felt like, again, there was just a life and a humor and an energy to his performance that otherwise was...
He's kind of a magnificent bastard that, like, he lacks that kind of self-aware, like, that guilt and sort of
cancerousness. And he loves the craziness of war and the nihilism of the war and the danger of war. And again, this does feel like a novel, you know? There's a
very... complete with the narration.
There's a scene where Nicolas Cage is...
To start reading chapter titles.
Nicolas Cage adding to the many crimes that he commits over the course of this, like he takes his gun and then he like removes all of the bullets from it, so he's like, you can't get me, blah blah blah. They're like, I spoken with him again, I would have told him that his friend died because he didn't have any bullets in his gun and he was ambushed. And it's like, bum bum bum, irony.
Person.
Oh good lord.
It's a weird little obscurity, and I think, you know, if you're a Cage completist like we are, and you probably are if you're listening to this podcast, it's maybe worth a look, but just like if you're ready to sort of accept the content warning of the sexual assault and everything else, like it's very violent, sort of acid-tongued picture.
Well, and again, I feel like it's interesting if you're into Nicolas Cage, also the ways in which it echoes and which it overlaps with The Vampire's Kiss. I think it's really interesting, and this is either the best or worst time to watch a sort of sweaty psychodrama about a dude who thinks he has a horrible illness and is going insane and is ready to kill himself for something that he may or may not have.
There are not enough scenes of him washing his hands.
And I liked that, like, towards the end there, he had a facial hair and stubble, and he was, like, sweaty. I'm like, how many days has this been? Like, it's very unclear the passage of time, how long anything's happened. And there was also a moment where he's like, I thought it had all been, like, some sort of weird dream. And this does feel like the sort of thing where had they been like, oh my god, this was just some weird fever dream that he had, you know, while he was on KP duty, that would not feel out of pace. That would feel kind of appropriate. That'd be kind of an apropos payoff.
Right.
This does feel very dreamlike in a good and bad way.
Yeah, it feels very nightmarish, to be
sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like very Wages of Fear almost, especially in the beginning when there's that weird sort of truck accident. That seems to kick off the whole thing. So I guess unless we have anything else to say about Time to Kill, maybe we could quick do the cage match before we actually talk a little bit about Postal. So this is probably the hardest cage match we've ever had, because usually what happens is one of the films is so demonstrably better than the other that it's easy to do. But now both films are like so weird and you know, so like murky in value that it might be a little bit of a toss up. So Nathan,
I'm gonna say Time to Kill, just because I found it, because
it's a real movie.
Well, it's a real movie. It's engaging. I found it relatively interesting. I felt like Nicolas Cage gives a really interesting, sweaty, dynamic method Nicolas Cage in the 1980s performance. So neither one is good, and the Time to Kill is incredibly problematic, and on a moral level, is a lot of things that are that are less than ideal. But yeah, there's just a life and an energy and a pulse to it that does not exist with Basements, where I was like, am I like coming down with something? Am I COVID-19? Or is this just kind of boring and I'm just kind of lethargic because I'm not being engaged intellectually by what's going on?
Right. Brock, what do you think?
You know,
is
what?
It the movie you've watched all the way through?
No. I think that I knew going into Cage Match today that it goes to Cage, because what Travolta does is not, it does not qualify as acting. I know, like, the
it's
definition.
It's a crime
of,
against
it
acting.
It is true. Like, it is awful to say this, but the things that happen in the Cage movie are not as bad as Travolta's mere acting. There should be a content warning for the acting. It was a truly awful experience. And at least the Cage one, I was like, this is fascinating, and there's a lot of things happening, and it seems like a mostly well-made movie that goes weird places. And then there's just a chunk in the middle that I was like, I understand that when this came out, this was acceptable for me and my life in 2020 and my belief system. I think I'm done with it. But like, I understand that it is objectively the better film. And certainly what I saw, Nicolas Cage is by far and away the better actor in it. He's still, as always, just Nicolas Cage, which is fine.
Right. That's why we started a podcast about him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is also why I wanted to be on for Vampire's Kiss, because that's the one time he's not Nicolas Cage. And it's awful, too. So,
yeah. Right, yeah, I think I'm probably gonna have to give this one to Time to Kill too, because at least it's a real movie.
Yeah,
that's the standard by which I'm weighing it. So yeah, let's talk about Postal. Talk to me about this little book of yours you guys got going on here.
For people that aren't in the know, there's a series called Boss Fight Books, and basically it follows the same as the 33 and a third series of books, which is covers music, and for them, each book is about a different album. And written by a different author, and there's sort of no rules to it. So in the 33 and a third series,
different video game.
Oh, what?
Yeah, you said a different author or a different album.
Yeah, well, in the 33 and a third series, is different album, different author, and there's no rules for them. So like sometimes an author writes about like their personal connection to an album, or they do a very dry like here is how it was produced and the process of making it, or they do sort of an oral history, or where they talk to other people around the band. It's just you pick a topic and you do whatever you want with it. And Boss Fight Books does the same thing, except in the video game world. And they've been doing it for 4 seasons now, where they sort of kickstart like 6 or 7 books at a time. And then over the course of the next year, those books come out and people can buy them. And so a lot of the books in the series have followed sort of a very similar path to the 33 and a third series, but a little more narrow. Like a lot of it has been, oh, this is the video game that helped me connect with my stepfather, or like this was my favorite video game as a kid, or a very dry, like here is how this game came to be, and sort of an oral history of the people that made it and problems with production. I pitched something that was too far outside of the box. I wanted to write a book about the Game Genie, which was a piece of hardware that allowed people to cheat on games on the early consoles, and how that sort of taught like me my first like elements of early programming and what that did. So it was not a game, and it was too far outside the box. And Nathan had pitched that he wanted to write about the movie Postal, the UV Bowl adaptation of the video games Postal. And Gabe, our editor, was like, what if the two of you work together? Brock, why don't you cover the game and Nathan cover the movie. And so I'd never had any interest in the game because I knew it was terrible. And like the last level of the game is you literally shooting up a grade school. And that came out a year and a half before Columbine happened. And so like Columbine, as we were looking for people to blame for it in media, it was like Marilyn Manson and Postal. And so like it was a terrible game made by terrible people. And then it's adapted by another terrible guy, Yvie Boll, into another equally terrible like pop culture thing. And so our book sort of is the first book in the series where people tackle things that are not good and that they do not like. And so it's, when we first announced it, there were people online, even friends of mine, that were like, why are you giving oxygen to these bad people? Why are you covering them? And it was like, well, our publisher had to actually come out and say, look, bad art deserves criticism too. And like, we can't look at the history of video games and media and just have it all be very rose colored lens. Like, wow, this was important and nice. We have to take a look at some things that are just awful, because otherwise we will keep making those same mistakes. And my new favorite part of it is that the creators of the game, who I went to interview and who I just spend more than 170 pages shitting on, they've actually been our biggest sellers of the book. They bought a giant box of it wholesale, and I just found out that in 48 hours of selling it, they've already sold out. So like, they're huge supporters, and they're also the sort of like South Park sort of shock, like they have a very Drive Time Radio shock jockey feel about them, and they enjoy being hated. So when they read the book, their comments to me were like, I wish you'd pointed out this thing or this other thing a little bit, but it's very funny how you just like constantly shit on us, and like they find it genuinely amusing. So I was like, all right, well, they're happy with it. And their one rule with me when I interviewed with them was like, we've never had like a profile written about us where anyone says anything good. So we're not expecting you to do that here. What we would ask, and this is the only thing that we've ever been mad about, is that you just quote us accurately. So I have my recording and I made sure to use their quotes. And usually I use a quote and then go like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, but like, that's what they said. And they're fine with that. They think it's very funny, but like I did good journalism while also yelling.
That's great. That's the dream, right?
Well, that's one of my favorite parts of the book. Could you talk a little bit about what that experience was like, meeting Vince Desi, his signature is an indication, apparently was the author of our book as well.
Oh, yeah, the books that they're selling out of their store, Vince Desi and Mike J, the two co-owners of the company, they're autographing it as if it was their book and selling it to their audience. And I was like, sure, that's genuinely funny. Like, there's so much about them that is genuinely funny. And the interesting thing is that, like, I think early on we should have made a different decision, which would have been to cover the game Postal 2, which is actually what the movie Postal is mostly adapted from. And Postal 2, while an equally, like, dark and fucked up game, is actually, like, much funnier. And that game, the first game is basically you're just shooting people because you're a crazy person, so you're shooting cops and like innocent civilians and like whatever, and there, it was early enough in gaming that there wasn't much of a story outside little like typed up cut scenes between levels, and you're like, none of this makes any sense, none of it's good. In the second game, they'd reached the point where it's a first person shooter and they had dialogue recorded. And it's mostly about a guy who just keeps trying to go about his life each day, like getting milk from the grocery store or returning a book to the library. And no matter where he goes, it's other people that start these shootouts because everyone in society is fucked up. So like when he goes to the library to return a book, feminazis are trying to burn down the library with him inside. And when he's waiting in line, just trying to get milk, all the people waiting in line that hate waiting in a line, they start shooting at each other, like in a Walmart or whatever. Like a mall is full of people that like it's a Black Friday situation and he needs to get out alive. And I was like, there is something much closer to the movie and much funnier and more interesting about like this thing that's just like, actually, it's not you that's crazy, it's society that's crazy and you're just trying to survive.
But
yes, it was in order to interview the two of them, I know that Nathan has his own interview stories to tell. Mine was that I drove to Arizona to spend a night at their house. So I grabbed a bottle of whiskey and sat down with them and turned on a recorder. And we just talked for like 10, 11 hours. And it was like, okay, like I can come to understand, like for Vince Desi, who's the guy who created the first one, his partner is Mike Che, who is a kid that is something 30 years younger than him. It turns out that Mike Che was his son's best friend in high school and just really loved the game while his son did not. So they went into business together. But Vince actually was one of the first people to work in video games back in the day. And he won awards from like Barbara Bush handed him a number of awards because he created a lot of educational video games. Like he made all the first Sesame Street games and so on and so forth. And he had a really successful business doing these childhood entertainment things. And one day he was like, I'm just so fucking tired of this. And his own personal falling down was he was like, I'm going to take a few people from my team and I just want to go make a game where we shoot people. And like, when I heard that, I like saw his awards from Barbara Bush for education. I was like, you know what? This makes so much sense to me. Now I understand where you came from, that you were like, I just can't help Big Bird spell anymore. I just want a game where I have a rocket launcher and I kill the police. Like, it's fine.
Was it out of a sense of like selling out and he needed to rebel against that? Or
I think he was just tired of doing it. Like, yeah, I imagine it's like the guy from Blue's Clues who left one day to start making albums with the Flaming Lips. Like, I imagine if you work long enough in children's entertainment and you're not Mr. Rogers, you finally one day go like, I want to be a fucking adult and do things that make me happy.
it's their purge.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one of the things that was interesting about how fucking long and drawn out and kind of psychodrama addled this whole process was it started in 2015, and I feel like the world was a much better, much more hopeful place at that point. I think, yeah, the process started right after I got laid off from the Dissolve. I had a bunch of people approach me and say, hey, we want to get into the Nathan Rabin business. And thank God, most people, they held off after a while. But yeah, I kind of felt like every year the world came closer and closer to Postal. And what seemed so crazy and extreme and out there in 1997 or in 2015 seems borderline sane these days. I happen to really like the movie Postal. I launch what I think is a pretty extensive defense of it, in part because I think it's fascinating. It's kind of an x-ray of Uwe Boll's soul. And I find Uwe Boll to be such a fascinating human being and so weird and interesting and angry and sensitive and full of rage and yearning for love and validation. Just all these complicated things all at once. And they're all kind of express themselves in this bizarre, you know, sort of John Waters, Troma-esque sort of comedy and sort of his look at the United States. And he's fascinating to me in part that he's obsessed with our country. And he's a German, he's a doctorate, he's Dr. Uwe Boll, and he's a German who makes all of his movies in Canada. There's this weird, like, double distance from it. And yeah, when I interviewed him, he was cleaning up from his children's Easter egg. So every once in a while, he would, like, yell something off stage there. And yeah, he kind of, you know, while we were working on this, he retired. You know, he stopped making movies and became a restaurateur. And if you follow his Twitter, and he's got a podcast and his YouTube videos, and yeah, if you follow his Twitter feed, part of it's just like incoherent rage at everybody, and part of it's this is what the appetizers are.
He at the restaurant. Comments, yeah.
So Gordon Ramsay, basically.
He always comments on pictures of my cats and seems to love them. And so, like, every time that I'm like, why do I fucking follow this guy that I know? A, is going to read the book and be mean to me, and B, is just like a giant piece of shit, and then out of nowhere he'll be like, wow, I love cats, your cat's so pretty or something. I'm like, you just bought yourself another month, Yubi.
Right, I was gonna say, like, I feel like on a long enough timeline he's going to get mad enough that he's going to want to box your cats.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the you know, his eccentricities is that he got so angry that people were criticizing him online that he said, I will challenge all of you to boxing matches, with the the sticky wicket being that he's actually a pretty accomplished boxer. So
which,
he beat the holy
which people
shit
did not know
out of all these nerds.
Five reviewers, including the head of the website Something Awful, and then he live streamed it.
Yeah.
And everyone went down in like one blow. You the people behind the internet websites for trolls are not the strongest dudes in the world.
No, we are not.
They're not Dave Bautista or anything. And yeah, the nice thing that happened after that was critics really started respecting him. You know, they said, we didn't like your movies, but once you started beating our kind up, that's when we really started to have you in our corner.
We started to go easy on you.
The first rule of criticism is to find the biggest critic in the room and beat them up on day one. That's
what Yeah, it's real prison rules.
Well, and just speaking again of like kind of the weird timely aspects of it, one of the it says that you, Puzzle has an amazing cast. Yui Boll, Dave Foley, Seymour Cassell is in this. David Huddleston.
The lead,
David Huddleston, The Big Lebowski, Vern Troyer, J.K. Simmons, Academy Award winner J.K. Simmons plays this candidate who just is
talk about whiplash.
He improvised his entire role. I get the sense that everybody improvised their role because nobody cared about the script, which is kind of a common quality for Postal. But back then the idea of a politician just spouting all these crazy conspiracies willy nilly seemed crazy and loony, and now the President of the United States is also a conspiracy theorist and is also a lunatic, and this plot involves a deadly virus and the apocalypse and terrible leadership that leads to our world's annihilation. So yeah, it kind of became uncannily, uncomfortably timely, this bizarre movie and this utterly notorious video game series. Although, Postal 2, which you talk about it, a certain extent, was featured in the background of the Black Eyed Peas video, Where is the Love? I think is an illustration of how terrible the world is. And PewDiePie. PewDiePie apparently has covered it a number of times as well. And PewDiePie himself is an illustration of why the world is so terrible. And an example of the world being terrible. But we would totally take it if PewDiePie decided to embrace this book the way The Running with Scissors.
Right. Well, and I'm interested in you know, because this is obviously going into the realm of video game adaptations, which has always been a very murky kind of.
What? Despite the crusading work of you,
this rare misfire.
People
in
don't
the realm
like
of video, game
video game. That's weird. That's weird to me.
Right. Right. But as someone who's like, I'm very interested in that sort of weird mess of video game adaptations to the point where like I'm really trying to carve out enough time to start a book on the history of video game adaptations. I feel like yes. Uwe Boll's video game adaptations things are like they're a world unto themselves, even within the sort of again murky level of quality. So like what. What sets them apart from even other video game adaptations? Is it kind of the sheer apathy and sort of German tax credit of it all?
Well, I mean, part of the story of the book is about the myth of Uwe Boll. And the myth of Uwe Boll is that he is the worst filmmaker in the world. That he is the worst filmmaker alive. And a lot of people, they would fucking embrace that. Be like, hell yeah, I'm the worst. I mean, in England Posse, they embrace the idea we're the most hated, we're the worst band in the world. It's like, fuck you. Whereas Uwe Boll is like, I'm so hurt that people think I'm the worst director in the world. I have this evidence, look at the shot I made, technology, and it's like, yeah, of the like 87,000 people making movies, obviously you're not the worst. But again, it's just this injury that he could never get over, and he could never alchemize into pride or swagger or defiance. It's just this hurt of like, I can't believe people think I'm the worst when objectively speaking, I'm near the worst, but I'm actually quite good. So that's another thing I kind of identified with, was the sense of hurt, the sense of defeat, the sense of you know, not being right for the world, being out of step with the world, and not really understanding it and feeling confused. And there's also just the matter of, you know, he had, you know, 4 or 5 years where he was making huge movies all over the world.
He worked with so many Oscar winners, and yes,
Kingsley.
Again, he can't be the worst
J.K.
director
Simmons.
Of the world.
Oh, totally, totally. And again, I think Postal is a hell of an interesting motion picture, and I've seen it 5 or 6 times, and I wrote a fucking book about it. So yeah, I think if you go in with an open mind and see it as just this wild, outrageous satire, almost Russ Meyer's like in its kind of excess, in its giddy, deliberate excess, I think it holds up surprisingly well.
Oh, paying attention to like Uwe Boll's non-video game movies, like Rampage,
which is just Postal. All of his movies are just about somebody that wants to shoot people. It's the perfect match of director and his oeuvre to this IP.
Right, exactly. So it's very well. Then also, there's this Auschwitz drama.
Oh, yeah. There's Assault on Wall Street, where they go crazy and kill people on Wall Street. And the thing that I love about the Rampage movies is the second one is literally an exact cross between Network and Dog Day Afternoon. Yeah. So Uwe Boll just looked at Sidney Lumet's like mid-70s output and is like, fuck yeah, I'm all over that. And there's a sense of like the lead character in Rampage is crazy, but he also has a philosophy, and he also is like this like Noah Chomsky meets, you know, a Hitler type figure. And there's this great scene where Uwe Boll, as like the station director, is listening to the character talk, and he's like, he is very crazy, but he's not wrong.
Waka, yep,
that is literally, that's how literally you have yourself, the director, acting in the movie.
This is what saying, the movie means.
Say, exactly. So that's fascinating to me. And again, people who think that, you know, the war. And then, God, the third one is called Rampage, like White House Down or President Down. And they're like, oh, this is a movie that builds up to him killing the President of the United States. It opens with the President having been killed. So it's this amazing, amazing thing. Smash Bros. Is also just an incredible sense of nihilism and exhaustion and defeat. And like, I've been raging at the world, and now I'm just fucking tired, and I just wanna make wonderful appetizers and spend time with my family and not be the most hated filmmaker in the world. I think that was very, very exhausting for him. That took quite a toll on his psyche.
And like,
if we were known as the worst podcasters in the world, yeah, I think that would kind of bum us out, both.
Postal is a movie that has that same sort of nihilism in such a different way that is actually really funny. Like the opening sequence of it is 9/11. But it's from the position of the hijackers in the plane as they start to realize that maybe the 72 virgins might be a lie, and that what they were doing isn't maybe the best idea. And they're like, you know what? Let's land the plane. But then it's all the like overweight white Americans that rush the cockpit and cause the plane to crash into the towers. And like, I remember seeing it the first time years ago when it first came out and being like, well, this is just the most offensive, stupidest fucking thing I've ever seen. And watching it now, I'm like, okay, that's a pretty legit American criticism, and actually pretty funny, because that reads as true to me. I was like, okay, like he has a sense of humor that you can find it when things get dark enough. And perhaps...
like, you know what the joke is, at least.
Exactly.
Thanks so much for coming on the show, Brock. Again, where can they find the Postal book?
The bossfightbooks.com website is a place that has links to almost all the places it can be found, including ebooks and options to get the ebook and a physical book. The ebooks come in all formats, so if you don't want to give Amazon money directly, you can still download it and put it on your Kindle.
Nice. And where else can they find your stuff?
Me, I'm at Brock Wilbur on all places, and I'm the editor of The Pitch in Kansas City at thepitchkc.com. We are the alt magazine of the city, and hopefully print journalism doesn't die along with everything else right now, but we're doing great work online about helping keep people aware of stuff, and also highlighting all the cool things that people are doing around the city to help their neighbors. So that's me.
Brock, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think that wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. And wherever you do subscribe, you know, please rate us and review us. It'll help us out a lot. You can find us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. You can send us emails at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. Find these posts and all other fine Nathan Rabin content on NathanRabin.com. And yeah, we'll see you next week. And if you'll excuse me, I need to go poo.
Okay.